evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening once again to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Round up everybody you know. Get them in front of the radio tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, is one of those nights. To trace back the worship of God to its simple origin, and to mark the gradual process of those degrading superstitions and unhallowed rites which darkened and finally extinguished his presence in the ancient world, is a study that I've undertaken for many years. At first, men enjoyed the blessings of nature like children. Without inquiring into causes, it was sufficient for them that the earth gave them herbs, that the trees bore them fruit, that the stream quenched their thirst. They were happy. Oh, they were happy. At every moment, though unconsciously, they offered a prayer of gratitude to Him whom as yet they did not know. And then a system of theology arose amongst them, vague and indefinite, as the waters of the boundless sea. They taught each other that the sun and the earth, the moon and the stars were moved and illumined by a great soul which was the source of all life, which caused the birds to sing, the brooks to murmur, and the sea, the great and mighty sea, to heave. To them it was a sacred fire, which shone in the firmament and in mighty flames. It was a strange being, which animated the souls of men, and which, when the bodies died, returned to itself again. They silently adored this great soul, this great spirit. That was in the beginning. And they spoke of Him with reverence and sometimes raised their eyes timidly to His glittering dwelling place on high. And they had no doubt that He existed because they saw the evidence all around them. They were in awe of the world in which they lived, the power of nature, the teeming wildlife, the majestic forests, the towering mountains, the endless plains of grass, with the teeming herds of wildlife so vast that the eye could not see the end of the herd. They watched as the sun coursed across the heavens during the day and dreaded the coming of the night and the beasts that prowled therein and huddled together in the darkness for their mutual safety, marveling at the carpet of stars above them and thankful for the nights when the moon shone bright and reflected the light of the power of that great soul, so that they could see the dangers that approached them in the darkness. Their life was simple and they were innocent, and life for the most part was very good. Soon they learned to pray. Pray probably began as wishful thinking when danger approached, or in the midst of the darkness of a moonless night when they could hear the howling and the growling and the pacing of the wild beasts back and forth in front of their cave, or their nook in the rocks, or beneath the tree into which they had climbed, seeking safety. And when those whom they loved lay dying, they uttered wild lamentations and flung their arms despairingly towards the mysterious great soul. For in times of trouble, the human mind, so imbecile, so helpless, so innocent, clings to something that is stronger than itself. At that time, they worshipped only the sun, the moon, and the stars, but not as gods, as most would believe, but as visions, or evidence, if you will, of the power and the presence of that divine essence which alone ruled and pervaded the earth, the sky, and the sea. They adored him, kneeling. With their hands clasped and their eyes raised, they offered him no sacrifices. They built him no temples. They were content to offer him their hearts, which were full of awe, in his own temple, which was full of grandeur. And some say that there are yet some barbarous islands where men have no churches nor ceremonies, and where they worship God reflected in the work of his thousand hands. And as you know, from past broadcasts where this subject has come up on telephone inquiries, that is my church, and that is the way I worship my God. But we're not speaking of the present day. Those ancient peoples were not long content with this simple service. Prayer, which had first been an inspiration, fell into a system. And men already grown wicked prayed the deity to give them abundance of wild beasts' skins and to destroy their enemies. They ascended great mountains. They sought out eminences and hills as if hoping that thus being nearer God, he would prefer their prayers to those of their rivals. That is the origin of that superstitious reverence for high places, which was universal throughout the whole of the heathen world. And then Orpheus was born, and he invented instruments which to his touch and to his lips gave forth notes of surpassing sweetness. And with these melodies, he enticed the wandering savages into the recesses of the forest and there taught them precepts of obedience to the great soul and of loving kindness towards each other in harmonious words. So they devoted groves and forests to the worship of their God. And there were other men who had watched Orpheus and who had seen and envied his power over the herd who surrounded him, what today we would call the masses, the sheeple. They resolved to imitate him, and having studied these barbarians, they banded together and called themselves their priests, and thus was born the priesthood, which exists to this day. Religion is divine, but its ministers are men, and sometimes they are demons with the faces and wings of angels. The simplicity of men and the cunning of their priests has destroyed or corrupted all the religions of the world. These priests taught the people to sacrifice the choicest herbs and flowers. They taught them formulas of prayer and bade them make so many obeisances to the sun and to worship those flowers which opened their leaves when the sun rose and which closed them as it set. They composed a language of symbols which was perhaps necessary, since letters had not been invented, but which perplexed the people and perverted them from the worship of the one God. And thus the sun and moon were worshipped as emblems of God, and fire as an emblem of the sun, water as an emblem of the moon. The serpent was to be worshipped also as an emblem of wisdom and eternal youth, since it renews its skin every year and thus periodically casts off all symptoms of old age. And the bull, the most vigorous of animals. And if you don't believe that, you've never been to Spain to a ranch which specializes in raising the pure line of fighting bulls, which are ultimately put to the death in the ring, but nevertheless, while they live, are truly, without a doubt, the most vigorous, the most robust, the most challenging, the most masculine of animals probably upon the face of this earth, and whose horns resemble those of the crescent moon. The priests observed the avidity with which the barbarians adored these symbols and increased them. To worship the visible, ladies and gentlemen, is a disease of the soul inherent to all mankind, and the disease which these men could have healed, instead they pandered to. Now, it is true, as some of you would argue, that the first generation of men might have looked upon these merely as the empty symbols of a divine being. But I can assure you that it is also certain that in time the vulgar forgot the God in the emblem and worshipped that which their fathers had only honored as a manifestation of the power of the invisible. Egypt, that great civilization, was the fountainhead of these idolatries, and it was in Egypt that the priests first applied real attributes to the sun and to the moon, whom they called his wife. It might interest you to hear the first fable of the world. And I've told you this story before, but I'm going to tell you again tonight, because it never hurts to repeat a lesson even to those who have heard it many, many times. For with the retelling, there was sometimes a new discovery. From the midst of chaos was born Osiris, and at his birth a voice was heard proclaiming, "The ruler of all the earth is born." From the same dark and troubled womb were born Isis, the queen of light, and Typhon, the spirit of darkness. This Osiris traveled over the entire world and civilized its inhabitants and taught them the art of agriculture. But on his return to Egypt, the jealous Typhon laid a stratagem for him, and in the midst of a banquet had him shut up in a chest which exactly fitted his body. He was nailed down in his prison, which cast into the Nile, floated down to the sea by the Titic mouth, which even in the time of Plutarch was never mentioned by an Egyptian except with marks of detestation. When Isis learned these sad news, she cut off a lock of her hair and put on her mourning robes and wandered through the whole country in search of the chest which contained the dead body of her husband. After a time, she learned that the chest had been carried by the waves to the shore of Byblos and had there lodged in the branches of a tamarisk bush. which quickly shot up and became a large and beautiful tree growing round the chest so that it could not be seen. The king of the country, amazed at the vast size the tree had so speedily acquired, ordered it to be cut down to be hewn into a pillar to support the roof of his palace, the chest being still concealed within the trunk. The voice which had spoken from heaven at the birth of Osiris made known these things to poor Isis, who went to the shore of Byblos and sat down silently by a fountain to weep. The damsels of the queen met her and accosted her, and the queen appointed her to be nurse to her child, and Isis fed the infant with her finger instead of with her breast, and put him every night into fire to render him immortal. While transforming herself into a swallow, she hovered round the pillar, which was her husband's tomb, and bemoaned her unhappy fate. It happened that the queen thus discovered her and shrieked when she saw her child surrounded by flames, and by that cry she broke the charm and deprived her child of immortality. But by that cry, Isis was summoned back to her goddess form and stood before the awestruck queen, shining with light and diffusing sweet fragrances around. She cut open the pillar, took the coffin with her, and opened it in a desert. There, she embraced the cold, dead corpse of Osiris and wept bitterly. She returned to Egypt and hid the coffin in a remote place, but Typhon, hunting by moonlight, chanced to find it and divided the corpse into 14 pieces. Again, Isis set out on her weary search throughout the whole land, sailing over the finny parts in a boat made of papyrus. She recovered all the fragments, except one which had been thrown into the sea. Each of these she buried in the place where she found it, which explains why in Egypt there are so many tombs of Osiris. And instead of the limb which was lost, she gave the phallus to the Egyptians and placed it upon the altar of their temples, the disgusting worship of which was thence carried into Italy, into Greece, and into all the countries of the East. And when Isis died, she was buried in a grove near Memphis. Over her grave was raised a statue covered from head to foot with a black veil, and underneath was engraved these divine words: I am all that has been, that is, that shall be, and none among mortals has yet dared to raise my veil. Beneath this veil are concealed all the mysteries and learning of the past. Many scholars throughout the ages, fingers covered with the dust of venerable folios, eyes weary and reddened by nightly toil, me included, have attempted over the years to lift a corner, just a little corner, of this mysterious and sacred covering. And tonight, I am revealing to you just a little of what I have found. These two deities, Isis and Osiris, were the parents of all the gods and goddesses of the heathens, or were indeed those gods themselves worshipped under different names. The myth, the fable, the story itself was received into the mythologies of the Hindus and the Romans. Sira is said to have mutilated Brahma, as Typhon did Osiris, and Venus to have lamented her slain Adonis, just as Isis wept for her husband God. As yet, the sun and moon alone were worshipped under these two names. And as I have demonstrated, besides these twin beneficial spirits, men who had begun to recognize sin in their hearts had created an evil one who struggled with the power of light and fought with them for the souls of men. Now, folks, it is natural for man to fabricate something that is worse than himself. Even as it is natural in times of terrible tragedy to look above for something that is greater than himself. Even in the theology of the Native Americans, which is the purest, probably, of the modern world, the most innocent, very, very close to that which existed in that long ago age, there is found a mahatau, or dark spirit. Osiris, or the sun, is now worshipped throughout the whole world, though under many different names. He was the Mithra of the Persians, the Brahma of India, the Baal or Adonis of the Phoenicians, the Apollo of the Greeks, the Odin of Scandinavia, the Hu of the Britons, and the Baiwi of the Laplanders. Isis also received the names of Islam, Ceres, Rhea, Venus, Vesta, Sibyl, Niobe, Melissa, Diana, Nihalinia in the north, Icy with the Indians, Pooza among the Chinese, and Caridwen among the ancient Britons. The Egyptians were sublime philosophers who had dictated theology to the entire world. And in Chaldea arose the first astrologers who watched the heavenly bodies with curiosity as well as with awe, and who made divine discoveries, and who called themselves the interpreters of God. They believed that the stars were the spirits of great men. Who had reached the point of apotheosis and had ascended into heaven as masters. And so to each star they gave a name, and to each day in the year they gave a star. And the Greeks and Romans, who were poets, read these names into legends. Each name was a person. Each person was a god. From these stories of the stars originated the angels of the Jews, the genii of the Arabs, the heroes of the Greeks, and the saints of the Roman Catholic Church. Corruption grew upon corruption, and superstition flung a black and hideous veil over the doctrines of religion. A religion is lost, ladies and gentlemen, as soon as it loses its simplicity. Truth has no mysteries. It is deceit alone that lurks in obscurity. Soon men multiplied God into 1,000 names and created him always in their own image. Him, too, whom they had once deemed unworthy of any temple less noble than the floor of the earth and the vast dome of the sky, they worshipped in caves and then in temples, which were made of the trunks of trees rudely sculptured at first, and ranged in rows to imitate groves, and with other trunks placed upon them traversely. And such were the first buildings of worship erected by man from no reverence for the deity, but to display that which they doubtless conceived to be a stupendous effort in art, something to impress, awe, and cower their flock. It may not be needless to remind many of you that a superior being must view the elegant temples with which we contemplate the rude efforts of those early heathens who deemed God unworthy of the fruits and flowers which he himself had made, and offered to him the entrails of beasts and the hearts of human beings, that which he had created as sacrifices unto him. How utterly absurd. We can compare an ancient and fallen religion to the ship of the Argonauts, which the Greeks, desiring to preserve to posterity, repaired it in so many different ways that at length there did not remain a fragment of the vessel which had borne to Colchis the conqueror of the Golden Fleece. If he had lived to see the end result, he would not recognize it as his own boat. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about ancient gods, ancient peoples, and ancient religions. So let's pass over a lapse of years and then contemplate the condition of these nations in whom religion had been first born. And we'll find the Egyptians adoring the most common of plants, the most contemptible of beasts, the most hideous of reptiles. The solemnity and pomp of their absurd ceremonies held them up to the ridicule of the entire world. Clemens of Alexandria describes one of their temples. The walls shine with gold and silver and with amber and sparkle with the gems of India and Ethiopia, and the recesses are concealed by splendid curtains. But if you enter the penetralia and inquire for the image of God, for whose sake the fane was built, one of the pastophori or some other attendant on the temple approaches with a solemn and mysterious face, and putting aside the veil, suffers you to attain a glimpse of the divinity. There you will behold a snake, a crocodile, or a cat, or some other beast, a fitter inhabitant of a cavern or a bog, than that of a temple. The priests of Egypt, always impostors, but once so celebrated, had now degenerated into a race of jugglers. Also, the Chaldeans lived upon the fame of their fathers and upon their own base trickeries. The Brahmins or Brahmins, those priests of India, once so virtuous and so wise, they too had fallen. Once they had forbidden the shedding of so much as an insect's blood. One day in the year alone at the feast of Jagan, they were authorized to sacrifice the flesh of a beast, and from this many had refrained from attending, unable to conquer their feelings of abhorrence. But now they had learnt from the fierce Scythians and from the Phoenicians who traded on their coast to sacrifice the wife upon her husband's pyre, to appease the gentle Brahma with the blood of men. And now the angels who had presided over them became savage demons who scourged them on to cruel penances, to lifetimes of suffering and famine. In the sacred groves where once the Brahmin fathers had taught their precepts of love, men, emaciated, careworn, dying, wondered sadly, waiting for death as tortured prisoners wait for their liberty. But worse still, oh yes, much worse still, these wicked priests sought through the land for the most beautiful young women and trained them to dance in the temples and to entice the devotees to their arms with lustful attitudes and languishing looks and with their voices, which mingled harmoniously with the golden bells suspended on their feet. They sang hymns to the gods in public, and in private enriched the treasures of the pagoda with their infamous earnings. And so a pure and simple religion was debased by the avarice and lewdness of its priests, till the temples became a den of thieves, until prostitution sat enthroned upon the altars of the gods. Greece and Rome, buried in sloth and luxury, did not escape this general contamination. The emblem of generation which Isis had bestowed upon the Egyptians, and which they had held in abstract reverence, had now obtained a prominent place in the festivals of these nations, as did the lingam in those of the Hindus. It was openly paraded in processions in the streets. It was worn by Roman nations in bracelets upon their arms. Look it up. The sacred festivals and mysteries which they had received from the Egyptians, and for which the women had been wont to prepare themselves by continence and the men by fasting, were now mere vehicles for depravities of the lowest kind. and even in Egypt, whence this all came. They had already corrupted the innocent reverence of God and God's creation, which was all of nature. Had taken man out of God's temple that God had built and put him into man's temples that man had built that could not even remotely begin to duplicate the grandeur or even come close to any kind of representation of God's temple, which was all of nature, the heavens that man could behold. Men were permitted to join the women in their worship of Bacchus, of Adonis, of the Bona Dea, and even of Priapus, and so dissolute did the Dionysia become that the civil powers, ladies and gentlemen, were compelled to interfere with those of religion, and the Bacchanalia were abolished by decree of the Roman Senate. It was so depraved that even the depravity of what we have studied, that were the men who occupied the great Senate of Rome, could not stand it. And the Jews, the chosen people of God, had not their religion changed? Had not God, weary with their sins, yielded them to captivity, scourged them with sorrow, menaced them with curses? They worshipped Baal Peor, the Priapus of Assyria. They sacrificed their children to Moloch. They had dancing girls in the holy temple. I'm not going to go deeper into particulars so degrading to human nature. I will rather invite you to follow me to a corner of the world where, at least for many ages, religion was preserved in its pristine purity, although misused, misdirected, and its power abused. But whose priests, through a barbarous soldiery, were received as martyrs before they had learned to be knaves upon this earth. It was an isolated spot, unknown to the world, in the earlier ages of vice. It became a great kingdom renowned for its power and for its luxuries from hemisphere to hemisphere. It abused its powers. It persecuted those peoples with whom it came in contact and whom it usually ended up ruling. And God eventually struck that empire down. But in its early days, it is worth studying. It was encircled by the blue waters of the German and Atlantic seas and abounded in the choicest gifts of nature. It was called the White Island from those cliffs which still frown so coldly upon Gaul, and the Land of Green Hills from its verdant mountains. And Monday night, I'm going to take you to its shores by a roundabout venture, and I will show you its priests in their white robes and its warriors in the blue paint of war and its virgins with their long and glossy yellow hair. And I will precede that, beginning Monday night, by leading you back into the past and relate to you why this land was called Albion. Why Albion? And indeed, why Britain? Doubtful. Many of you may be. What you've heard tonight is the truth. Many of you will ask, what is the purpose of this? Well, you're going to find out next week that the ancient religion that we're studying is still practiced today by many who hold a terrible power over us, within our own government and in governments around the world. And it is this duplication of the misuse of the power and the ability to hold knowledge and technology and secrecy over the ignorant herds of sheeple, if you will, who are so trusting and so believing and so magnificently faithful that they willingly follow the Judas goat to the shearing pens and then ultimately to the slaughterhouse. And so I advise you to pay close attention to these lessons, and don't be stupid, and don't be foolish, and don't think that you know all the answers, because there are very few of you in this listening audience who have ever, ever bothered to study anything beyond the end of your own nose, nor have you ever listened to any other than the liar who stands behind the pulpit of your church and preaches to you the doctrines that cause you to follow these Judas goats. And there's many more than one, believe me. Everything in this world that is happening today is happening because of four things, ladies and gentlemen: race, religion, power, and greed. Race, religion, power, and greed. If you do not understand the history of religion and how it manipulates and controls vast numbers of people on this earth, then you are one of those being manipulated and controlled.
Tonight's broadcast was taken in part from W. Winwood Reed's long-lost classic entitled The Veil of Isis, or Mysteries of the Druids, and from my own personal research. Good night, folks. God bless each and every single one of you. Good night, Annie Poon Allison. I love you.
Thank you.